Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing okay, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Today is my birthday, but by the time you hear this, my birthday will be past. I had one person call me today and wish me a happy birthday. It would be you. You're the only person that called me and wished me a happy birthday. Everybody else, it's all on, you know, the interwebs, Facebook likes, mentions, so probably have over 100 maybe happy birthdays online, but you're the only person that called me that was a human being. Now, my phone has actually been ringing off the hook for the last 2 weeks, pretty much since we decided to cover the Mothman. And when I answer it, it's weird beeping noises. I've been going on the webpage and blocking all the numbers that it comes from, so I'm slowly weeding it out. But if anyone out there wants to go look up the number and tell these people to stop calling me, the latest number that they dialed from was 816-448-0467 or 816-448-0444. And if you want to call them, send them faxes, whatever, I don't care because they've been blasting me for 2 weeks. I think it's a robo-dialer. Who do we got to thank?
Well, we'd like to thank some people for just their contributions to the show. Trevor Strickland and Dana Cunningham. And also a special thank you to Lindsay Taylor. You've wanted to cover the Mothman for quite a while. And we have a listener, Vincent Caldoni, who decided to send us the book.
Yeah.
He wanted to make sure we covered this.
Yeah. Mothman Prophecies, John Keel.
And Justin read the book.
I read it, and then I had to go back through, and I highlighted, and Aaron's looking at the book right now, and I've folded pages and highlighted the heck out of it. And there's going to be a few passages that I might read from the book that I found choice. Now, there's a little bit of pressure on this episode, because normally when we don't cover murder, mayhem, and sad stuff, and we cover Bigfoot or Mothman or something, It's our break. It's our easy episode that we can go off and get a break from murder on. But people are really looking forward to this episode. And now I feel like the pressure's on, but whatever.
Let's give a summary for the Mothman case.
We'll give our own summary, because if I tried to give a John Keel summary, it would just sound like garbage. Point Pleasant, West Virginia, 1960s. Depending on, you know, when you think the first sighting happened. So there were weird sightings and there were anomalies that were happening. So you had UFOs, people seeing crafts, people seeing cigar-like crafts in the air, flying around, flashing in the sky. People were getting weird phone calls to their phones with weird beeping sounds and voices and whistles, stuff like that. Again, I've been getting those for the last 2 weeks, but I'm not reading too much into it. And
not yet, you aren't.
And then it all culminates into they see a creature. Contrary to popular belief, descriptions of this creature vary drastically. They say it's between 6 and 10 feet tall. It's gray or it's brown. Some say it has fur. Some say it has feathers. Has a 10-foot wingspan. Not glowing eyes, but red eyes. When it flies, it raises its wings, but it needs not flap the wings. And it can chase cars that are going up to 100 miles per hour. Hangs outside windows. It mostly goes after cars. It's kind of like a dog chasing a car. And people that see it, before they even see it, they're overcome with a feeling of dread. So before they see the creature, they get a feeling. While they're seeing the creature, they're terrified, and all they want to do is get away. After they've seen the creature, and this is sort of inconsistent, some of them reported that their eyes were bleeding and puffy and swollen. The first actual reported sighting of the Mothman, 1966. Two young couples on November 15th are driving their 57 Chevy. They're in this place called the TNT area, which is an old munitions factory, or defunct munitions factory that was for World War II.
Yes, they had a bunch of storage buildings on the property that they called igloos. And they would manufacture and store TNT there. And at the height of production during World War II, they would produce 500,000 pounds of TNT every day. And the area would become contaminated after it was shut down. They found that the area was contaminated with both DNT and TNT. DNT is just a precursor to TNT.
Yeah. And it's, what are those super cleanup sites that... I forgot what they're called, but it's deemed one of those. So great job. This has kind of become the Lover's Lane sort of area, it seems, where kids would go hang out there because it's sort of isolated and off the beaten path. So these kids are there and this monster shows up. They see the red eyes. They get scared. They drive away, and it follows them. And they claim they get their car up to 100 miles per hour. The thing kept up, and they drive back into town.
The creature they see, they describe as being 7 feet tall with wings that were folded against its back.
They say once they got into town where the lights were, street lights and whatnot, that seemed to discourage this creature from following them any further. And they drove directly to the courthouse and ran inside and told their story to the sheriff, George Johnson. The newspaper got a hold of it and they wrote an article.
Couple sees man-sized bird, creature, something was the headline.
Yeah. And then the article goes on to say it definitely wasn't a flying saucer. Two Point Pleasant couple said they encountered a man-sized bird-like creature in the TNT area. Sheriff's deputies and city police went to the scene at about 2 o'clock in the morning, but were unable to spot anything. The two young men telling their story in the morning were dead serious and asserted that they had not been drinking. I don't know why they always associate drinking with hallucinations. I've never been drunk and thought I saw something weird. I mean, when you're drunk, you might say weird things, but seeing things, that doesn't happen. I just stop like asking somebody if they're drunk. That's just not, you can ask them if they're on PCP or meth, but don't ask them if they're on alcohol.
I know, it's so weird. I've drank plenty in my lifetime. I've never seen anything odd drinking.
I know. I think it's a throwback to old 50s cartoons where, you know, drunks saw elephants dancing or something. I don't even know. They describe it as 7 feet tall, having a wingspan of 10 feet, and red eyes about 2 inches in diameter and 6 inches apart. It was like a man with wings. It's obvious that the newspaper actually isn't taking it very seriously. I mean, they're kind of just reporting it. They speculated that the thing was living in a vacant power plant, possibly in one of the huge broilers. There were pigeons in all those buildings, but this wasn't a pigeon. If I'd seen it while I was by myself, I wouldn't have said anything, Scarberry says. He's one of the couples. It didn't resemble a bat in any way. Maybe you could visualize something as an angel. The last time they saw it was at the gate of the C.C. Lewis farm on Route 66. They heard a sound like wings flapping, and they say the bird rose straight up like a helicopter. This doesn't have an explanation to it. It was an animal, but nothing I've seen before. Are you going back to look for the creature? Yes, this afternoon and again tonight. This is them quoted in the newspaper. After this newspaper article comes out, several more sightings are reported, but a lot of these sightings are actually prior. They say that it happened, you know, days earlier. So there's one sighting of these men at a graveyard that are digging a grave for a family member, and they reported that they saw this thing up in a tree, and then it flies over them. Their description is somewhat similar. But after the newspaper article, everybody starts seeing this thing, and reports start flooding in, along with UFO reports, which are just, they're so numerous that there's not one that just stands out. The local news would interview people. You can find their interviews online. They're standing out in their front yards talking about the craft, you know, landing in their front yard or flying over their house or whatever. There's more reports of UFOs than there are of the actual Mothman.
So we talked about how there are numerous UFO sightings, even more sightings of strange craft than there are of Mothman.
And there's weird men in black.
People who had sightings, people who had information to share with others about strange craft sightings or seeing Mothman, were being pressured by men in black not to talk about these things.
Yeah. Quick note on the men in black and how they're described, at least in the Mothman prophecies. You know the movie Men in Black with Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, right? Nothing like them. But you know in the movie Men in Black, the weird cockroach creature that has the skin on it that's really dumb? The weird alien? That's how the men in black are actually described in the book, is being awkward, rude, and weird, as if their skin and their clothes do not fit them properly. Not human, really.
There's a sewing machine salesman named Woodrow Durenberger. And on November 2nd, 1966, he's driving from Marietta, Ohio to Mineral Wells, West Virginia, where he lives. He's 50 years old, and he's driving on I-77. Now, just outside Parkersburg, West Virginia, Durenberger says that a vehicle passes him, and then about 30 feet behind that vehicle is another vehicle. He just assumes it's a car until he actually looks over at it, and he realizes that's not a normal vehicle because it's above the ground, so it doesn't have any wheels, and he says it resembles a kerosene lamp chimney. It's flared at both ends, and it has a bulge in the center. and it's flying 8 to 10 inches above the ground. It passes him, and then it turns crosswise in front of him and starts slowing down gradually, which forces him to slow down, and he goes to the roadside to a stop.
So he just described a land speeder from Star Wars. Okay.
Essentially, it moves like that. He says it flies above the ground. And then a door on the side opens up, and a man steps out. He says a man with a good tan, like a good suntan. And as soon as he steps out, this craft goes straight up about 75 feet or more up in the air.
That's a good parking place for it.
And hovers.
Yeah.
The vehicle that this man steps out of is charcoal colored, and it has no apparent windows or lights.
But it has a door passageway thing that disappears and reappears.
It's 35 feet in length and 8 to 9 feet in height and width. And he says the man starts walking in front of the vehicle, heading towards the passenger side. The way he's parked at the side of the road, if the man were to go to the driver's side, he would be in the roadway. So as the man's crossing in front of the headlights, he's already speaking to Durenberger telepathically.
Mind to mind.
And he's telling him to please lower his passenger side window, and he does. He wants to know his name. As Woodrow says it, he says, I know my name, so I tell him my name.
Well, because he thinks it, so he can tell him.
This strange man tells Durenberger that he has an option. He can either think to him, or he can speak to him. Either way works.
Yeah. Got to give a man options.
The door appeared like a normal car door when it opened. The man appeared to be 35 to 40 years old in appearance. When he was talking to Durenberger, he said, why are you afraid? He said, we wish you no harm. We wish you only happiness. And he mentions this a couple times to him, basically saying, hey, you've nothing to fear here.
Yeah, but asking him, why are you afraid? Idiot.
So he thinks, telepathically questions Woodrow, what is that place over there? And over there is Parkersburg, West Virginia. And so he tells him, he said, that's Parkersburg. It's a city. And this man who identifies himself, he gives his name as Cold. He says, oh, do people live there? And Woodrow says, well, they live around the city, but people conduct their business there. They shop and they conduct business there. He also asks Durenberger if he has to work for a living. Woodrow explains what he does, and Cold explains that he's a searcher. Now, when Woodrow was asked about this later, he said that he didn't know what Cold was searching for.
Why did he have to ask him? I don't know.
We don't really know. After they're talking about Parkersburg, Cold says, oh, where I come from, we call that a gathering.
Fine.
Woodrow's looking at this man. He's also looking up at this vehicle that's up in the sky, and it's very dark out. But he says he can see these things. He can see them just fine, even though everything's really dark. He says the man is 6 feet tall, weighs about 180 pounds, and he looks very normal, and he smiles. He just seems very friendly. He said he was really only scared because he didn't know what was happening. He didn't understand the vehicle.
But now everything's cool.
He's never believed in flying saucers, and he can't explain what's going on with this stuff, but he has a feeling that if someone had described it to him without his having seen it, he would think they were a nut. He said the man's outfit is glossy, and it looks sort of like a suit. He has a top coat. He has a shirt underneath. There's no tie, and he's wearing pants. But he said there's nothing really special about this man. He doesn't look like an alien. Other than, he said, where I come from, we call that a gathering.
Well, he could have been from New York, and that's just club wear. I don't know what the kids are calling drug use in those days. So,
now, at the end of this visitation, or whatever it is, he said, Cold suddenly stepped back and said, we will be seeing you again. And the craft came down, he got into it, and then it shot back up.
Who's we? He was by himself.
When he was getting back into the craft, he saw another man's arm come over and close the door. And he said that arm was clad in the same kind of material and looked normal, looked like a normal hand, but it was another person in the craft.
So what was the point of this visit?
We don't know.
There was idle conversation. There was no point to the conversation besides, we'll be seeing you again. And if he's telepathic, why did they even land? Whatever.
Many people say that the man that Durenberger saw was Indrid Cold. There's a legend about this man, or whatever he is, and there were other sightings described. One such sighting was on October 16th of 1966. Two boys, Martin and Jimmy, were walking in New Jersey and saw a strange figure by a fence. He was tall, bald, which differs from Woodrow's account because he said that the man had a full head of hair, and that he was wearing a shiny green suit, and he was staring at them, grinning, and that he would chase the boys. Now, the other sighting that I took a note on was about a girl named Linda Lilly. They say that her family was experiencing poltergeist activity at their house, and one night she went to sleep, and when she woke back up at some point, she saw a big, broad man grinning at her. And of course, she was terrified because there was some strange man in her room. And she pulled the covers up over her head. And a short amount of time later, she pulled the covers back down to look around. And he had disappeared.
What does this have to do with Mothman?
Well, I think the only way to explain this is that people who are into the Mothman story have collated all of the strange stories and sightings that were reported in the area during this time between 1966 and 1967, and they put them all together because they're all weird.
Yeah.
It's not as though someone said, I saw that charcoal-colored craft that was flying 8 inches above the ground and passed me, only when the door opened, I saw Mr. Cold, and I saw Mothman riding shotgun.
It's like an American Horror Story season where they just packed way too much stuff into one season, and they should have just took out a few of the subplots, because now you have telepathic aliens, you have all kinds of different aliens that are visiting because they're in different craft. I don't think, you know, I don't know if they have different brands of UFOs that they buy, but
Fords and Chevys and Toyotas.
Yeah. And then you have sightings of large birds, such as ostriches and oversized owls and other land-based birds.
Cranes.
And people say they saw like huge birds, size of deer, in the woods. And they were so startled that they didn't shoot them with their gun. These are all there. So you have mutant animals, UFOs, Mothman, poltergeists, like
a menagerie.
Yeah. Mothman is not about a Mothman. Maybe 1/10 of the story. It's not just people, you know, it's not like a Bigfoot or any other cryptozoology creature or whatever. It's not like that.
In fact, John Keel has a book, Strange Creatures from Time and Space, where he talks about all these different things.
Mm. It's like the place has been cursed. Was there ever a curse levied on this small town of Point Pleasant?
Yes. Well, and that's where some of these events, we don't know if they're a curse. I mean, getting pulled over by a space alien and being subjected to idle conversation, I don't know if that's a curse. Maybe if you have to pee really bad, but there was supposedly a curse as it was a result of the murder of a Shawnee chief. I won't try saying his name. He has actually a couple of names, but he goes by Cornstalk because his name translates to cornstalk or blade of corn. He was born around 1720. Settlers were displacing native tribes. And when he was about 10, his family was displaced from Ohio. He would end up becoming a chief, and he fought with the French against the British during the French and Indian War. It's also known as the Seven Years' War. It ran from 1754 to 1763, and it's all in this area, Ohio, West Virginia, Virginia. After the French and Indian War, Cornstalk, in July of that year, Cornstalk and about 60 warriors crossed the Ohio River in canoes and then moved overland for about 160 miles to the Muddy Creek Settlement. There are a couple of settlements around the Greenbrier, West Virginia area, which people might remember us talking about on last week's episode. The settlers allowed Shawnee and the others into their homes, and they sort of settled in together, you know, just talking or visiting. The settlers were being very kind to them because, you know, it is a strange time. Some of the settlers are very open to visiting with these native tribes, and others are very suspicious of them or want their land. So it's sort of a mixed bag. You don't know what could happen in any given area. But the Shawnee, after a little bit, would suddenly strike after the settlers had sort of let their guards down. And they would bring out their tomahawks and they would strike the settlers and scalp some of them, except for the women and children who they took as prisoners. After this, most of them would move 20 miles to the Clendenin settlement, which was led by Constable Archibald Clendenin at the Levels. We're not sure why all the settlers at this camp were gathered at Clendenin's home. There's a couple of different stories here. All these settlers are kind of spread out over a large area, but they're part of the same settlement. Now, Archibald was said to be a great hunter. He was about 28 years old. He had a wife and he had a few children. They say that he killed three elk and had invited all of the settlers in his camp to his house for a great feast. Another version says that the arrival of the Shawnee piqued their interest and their curiosities, and they just wanted to come visit. Either way, the settlement was normally scattered over a large area, but everyone was gathered at the Clendenin home. Between 50 and 100 settlers. It's really hard to tell. The Shawnee suddenly attack and kill all the men, and they take the women and children as prisoners. Clendenin's wife is very brave, I would say. She is ticked off by what's happening. She basically just gives them what for. I mean, she probably shouts obscenities and tells them they're cowards. In the end, she will die, as will her children. One man survived because he was out working. He saw what was going on and he fled. He's the only survivor. But what this does is it lets you know that this chief was a rough character because he was not taking the settlers and the displacement of his people very well. He was fighting back.
As he should.
In 1773, the colonials preemptively strike. They're getting tired of the American Indians fighting them, and they start killing Shawnee in raids on Shawnee towns, and they even kill some family members of a Mingo chief. This is their way of saying, we're taking this territory. That same year, Colonel Angus MacDonald and a regiment were dispatched to prevent the Confederacy. There were these seven nations of American Indians, the Shawnee, Delaware, Mingo, Wyandot, Illinois, and Ottawa, that were forming a group to fight back. And they found out about it. So they were like, nope, we're going to stop this in its tracks. We don't want this, you know, to get started because then we have a large mass of American Indians that will attack us. And that's trouble. They went there. They destroyed homes. They took some of the people hostage. By that point, the Confederacy had already been agreed upon, and Cornstalk was the chieftain of this Confederacy. Virginia Governor John Murray, Earl of Dunmore, decides to end the hostilities between the American Indians and the colonists by crushing the Shawnee. He is done giving up any kind of territory to them because they did not want to give up any territory at all. And the Confederacy amassed over 1,000 warriors. They went along the Ohio River, ready to attack a fort at the Point Pleasant area. And a battle would break out. They would try to cut off some of the regiments from the others. It was a strategy. They wanted to attack some of them so that they would have a better chance at winning the battle. But they would lose. And the reason they lose is because both sides took losses, but Cornstalk issued a retreat order. He gave it a valiant effort. During the battle, even the colonials heard him shouting, "Be brave." And they said he was a great commander. He commanded a lot of respect, and he really urged his men on, and it was to no avail because they retreated. In 1777, he and Red Hawk, a Delaware chief, and another man from the tribe met with Captain Arbuckle to negotiate a peace. Now, what was happening was some of the Confederacy was wanting to fight on, and Cornstalk went there to say, "Hey, we don't want any more battles with you guys. We just basically want to cut our losses. But if the Confederacy calls us in, we might have to fight with them, or at least our people will." Arbuckle says, "Whoa, we might have to fight you guys? Well, guess what? We'll just take you into our custody." And he takes them into custody. They sort of hang out together. So they're treated well and they're fed. It's said that Cornstalk may even have helped them draw up maps to understand the area better. And then his son shows up and he's taken into custody. Two of the soldiers are outside. This is a short time after they're taken into custody. These two soldiers are ambushed. One of them is killed. So the other soldiers are like, "Screw this. We're going to take revenge on Cornstalk, his son, this other chief, and this other man." They confront Cornstalk, who stands proudly in front of them, and they gun him down with 8 to 11 shots. But here's where a curse comes in. They say that before he dies, he says, "I was the border man's friend. Many times I have saved him and his people from harm. I never warred with you, but only to protect our wigwams and lands. I refuse to join your pale-face enemies with the redcoats. I came to the fort as your friend, and you murdered me. You have murdered by my side my young son. For this may the curse of the Great Spirit rest upon this land. May it be blighted by nature. May it even be blighted in its hopes. May the strength of its peoples be paralyzed by the stain of our blood." This is the curse. Now, what they say is, Point Pleasant is in this area. Point Pleasant gets established in 1794. But this curse is given the day he dies. In 1909, they erect an 87-foot-tall monument to Cornstalk. It was due to be dedicated, but the night before, a crane that was to be used to place the monument in its place was struck by lightning, and so the dedication was delayed for a month. In 1921, another lightning strike damages the capstone and some of the granite blocks. In 1944, the Appalachians tornado outbreak happens, and a tornado hits the tri-state area, killing well over 100 people. In 1968 and 1970, two different airliners would crash. The dead totaled 110. 1978, a freight train derails, spilling thousands of gallons of toxic chemicals, contaminating Point Pleasant's water supplies, and all the wells are shut down. Another incident in 1978, 51 men died when construction scaffolding that they were standing on at the Willow Island power plant collapsed. And that's 74 miles northeast of Point Pleasant.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
So these are the results of the curse that Cornstalk had made against the land. But if you've read anything on Mothman, there's one incident that they say is the biggest incident.
Yeah.
When you look at this case, it's the one that everyone talks about, and that is
the collapse of the Silver Bridge.
The Silver Bridge was a big deal because at the time, there was no easy way for people in, say, Kanawha, Ohio, to get to Point Pleasant, West Virginia. There's this man, Dr. Charles Holzer. He's the only surgeon in the tri-state area. He forms a committee to plan the bridge project. They're going to build a bridge, and this is going to be a big deal. Long story short, they build this bridge, and it's technologically advanced. It's a two-lane I-bar suspension-type bridge that spans 2,235 feet. It ends up opening in 1928. It's the first of its type in the United States. The only other one that was built of its kind was built in Brazil not too long before this one was built. Bridge like this, inspections were handled by the private owner from 1928 until 1941, and that's when they became the responsibility of the State Road Commission. And inspections would be done according to the state standards. And then after an inspection in 1965, $30,000 in recommended repairs are made. During the summer of 67, two inspections were done, and the State Road Commission area maintenance engineer visited the bridge on December 6th of that year. On December 15th, 1967, during rush hour, a loud gunshot sound is heard, and then the bridge starts folding like a deck of cards in under 20 seconds. At the time, there were 32 vehicles, 64 people fell in. And by falling in, I mean below them is the river. Also ground. There is ground underneath part of the bridge. And it's like there ends up just being a giant pile of wreckage and bridge there. Of the 64 people that fell in, 46 people died. They died from being crushed, from trauma, a lot of them from drowning because they were in vehicles. State Trooper Rudy O'Dell was probably the first officer on the scene. When he got there, there was a pregnant woman, Charlene Clark. She was standing there and apparently, she had thrown her car into reverse as soon as the bridge started shaking, and she had room to back up, but her car died as soon as she threw it into reverse. So it had lurched backward, and even though the car had died, because it was on an incline, she rolled back enough to get off the bridge. He said that he moved forward towards where the bridge was to see what he could do. He said, "I could hear them hollering for help. I didn't know how many there were at the time. There was nothing I could do. It was a long way out into the water. Nobody could get to it." He would end up being stationed on a river barge to assist in the recovery of bodies and vehicles from the Ohio River. He would tag victims so that their location was recorded before they were sent to the morgue. And online, you can see an image. It's like a drawing of the bridge. And they have all the numbers of where all the victims were located and where their cars were located. And down below the image, you can see all of the names of the people that went in and who survived and who didn't. 80% of them drowned, and then the rest of them died from trauma. Only 5 people were rescued from the water. One man, last name Boggs, reported that he was in his vehicle when they went down. In his vehicle was his wife and very young daughter. I think she was less than 2 years old. He said he went out his window. There was nothing he could do to save them. You can only imagine the kind of trauma that was going on. And everybody that was there, they all had a slightly different account of how it went down, depending on where they were on the bridge. Some people reported hearing a gunshot. Some people said it was swaying or going up and down before it collapsed.
Because of all the traffic on it. Because it's Christmas traffic, too.
The water temperature at the time was 44 degrees. And as soon as they could, they sent boats out to try and rescue people. But it was not good weather. It was the end of the year. It's winter time. The cleanup involved the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. They used 50-ton cranes to lift pieces of the bridge and trucks and cars from the river. 17 of the vehicles ended up on the shoreline past the collapse. 4 died who fell in that area. So if you fell not in the water, but if you fell in the shoreline, many more of those people survived.
Yeah, because if they weren't crushed, they weren't going to drown.
Yeah, 24 of the 31 vehicles fell into the river. Most fell straight down. A few ended up being carried downstream. There was a taxi driver. When they pulled his taxi cab out of the water, they would leave the bodies in the vehicle until they got the vehicle somewhere safe where they can inspect it. The taxi driver who was driving the cab was dead, and so was his rider. But when they were removing their bodies, the passenger still held the dollar in his hand that he was going to give to pay for the taxi ride. They attribute this to either the cornstalk curse, or they say that the Mothman was sort of like a premonition. It was a warning that there was a tragic event yet to come, right? Isn't that what they say?
Well, there's a divide there. You have people that say the Mothman caused it, or they were saying that he was forewarning. But as they say in the movie, their motivations are not human.
But Mothman never talked, right?
No.
It's not like Mothman said, hey man, stay off the bridge. And but John Keel was told not to go to Point Pleasant, was he not?
But his understanding was that when President Johnson was going to do the Christmas tree lighting, there was going to be a major blackout. His premonition, his idea was that there was going to be a serious blackout. He went back to New York. So at the actual time of the bridge collapse, he was hanging out with some people and nothing happened. But then the Christmas tree lighting video was interrupted. This broadcast is interrupted. Breaking news of the bridge collapse. There is a side story of Roy Kirby started getting obsessed with Mothman or this creature, and he is said to have taken his camera out to the bridge and filmed in the woods. He says he had hours of footage where he actually spotted the Mothman. He says that he took footage in front of the bridge because he knew it was going to collapse. He even made some claims that he had footage of the actual bridge collapsing with Mothman on it. And because he was hanging out by the bridge, the FBI needed to interrogate him because they thought that he was a terrorist and that he had brought the bridge down himself because he was videotaping and photographing. There were other reports of the men in black on the bridge prior to the collapse also, but Roy claims that the FBI took him into an interrogation room and took all of his footage that he had of the Mothman and the bridge collapse. So I wasn't able to find any of that because apparently the FBI confiscated it and they have possession of it. I don't even know if this man actually owned a camera, if the FBI actually talked to him. You can't verify any of it. It's all his word to John Keel, pretty much. This bridge collapses. Why does it collapse? There's actually a failure that happens that brought the whole thing down.
So there are a good number of people out there that believe that either Mothman caused the collapse, or, as you said, it could be he was just a warning that it was going to collapse. But they did a full investigation into the bridge collapse. They recovered all of the pieces of the bridge.
Reassembled them in a nearby field, kind of like what they do with airplane crashes. They reassemble all the parts and all the pieces.
They inspect everything. Now, the thing about this technologically advanced bridge is, yes, technologically advanced for the time, they didn't have a good way of inspecting the bridge. Not really. Because the way it's put together, I-bars, there are like these, they look like wrenches and they overlap. And so you can't really see if there's any corrosion in between or on certain parts of the bridge because they don't have a way to see through anything, obviously. So the bridge could have been compromised, but they know it was compromised because they found a crack in I-bar number 330. And they can tell that it was a crack that was, it was formed at the time it was molded. It had a crack that had existed ever since the bridge went live in 1928. And so you're asking yourself, well, wait a minute, 1928 to 1967? Get this. When they built that bridge and they had vehicles riding across it for the first time, they were Model Ts.
Yeah. 1920s vehicles.
Now, later on, they have cars and trucks and dump trucks. These dump trucks are almost 20,000 pounds.
They say it's a miracle this bridge lasted as long as it did. The I-bar design, think about a bike chain. There are bridges that are still around this to this day that are I-bar designs, but they're like, I don't know, five or six bike chains in the link as opposed to one, which was the Silver Bridge.
And also their techniques for inspection are much better due to advanced equipment and understanding of what to look for.
But being that it's a chain, it's only as strong as its weakest link, and they installed a faulty bar.
Over the years, when heavier and heavier vehicles, more and more vehicles were using this bridge, remember, there are times at rush hour where they're all stopped on the bridge and they're just sitting on the bridge.
Yeah. There's stoplights on each side of the bridge. So when the bridge is backed up, these lights turn red and they don't allow you to cross it. So the one lady that you were talking about, the light turned green. She pulled out onto the bridge, got spooked, threw her car in reverse, backed up back beyond the joint that where it collapsed. So they had traffic jams on this bridge. Plus, it's West Virginia. You know, it gets hot and it gets cold there. So you got expansion, contracting metals. This was a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah, there have been other bridge collapses. There was a huge one that happened in Minnesota, but I think only 10 or 11 people died in that one, despite many more vehicles going into the water. But they know this was a flaw that just gave out at some point.
And there was no way for them to inspect it properly, and it had zero redundancy because it only had one chain. These bridges are in, like, I think Boston right now, but if one I-bar were to break, there's six more. Whereas on this bridge, the I-bar, the little loop broke, and that bolt that holds them all together slid out, and you're done. I would put this more on the curse than Mothman if I had to choose, because at least in the guy's curse, he says nature will attack you. Well, nature causes corrosion, right? I mean, that's what happened here. But really, it was man's fatal flaw, not nature.
And I would say that if the chief was shot 8 to 11 times with rifles, I don't think he has enough breath to make this curse. You heard me read it. It's a long curse. I don't think you could. I could imagine him going, ah,
yeah,
but not, all right, listen to me because I'm going to address what happened here.
Point Pleasant in 2013, their population was at 4,300 people. That's not very many. I can only assume that in 1967, it was probably less. So there's not that many people. The reason why I'm pointing this out is because they say a lot of the victims on the bridge were relatives or knew people that had witnessed Mothman. When you live in the town that has less than 5,000 people and it's Christmas, rush hour, I'm betting you know your neighbors, and I'm betting that there's a really good chance that some of the people you know or your relatives are going to be on that bridge when it comes down.
They had a lot of phone calls coming in asking if they knew if so-and-so was okay.
Yeah. So I don't see any connection to the people that actually witnessed Mothman to the victims on the bridge. It's just a small town, so that's all there is to it. Some of the victims, some of the survivors or people that witnessed Mothman said that they were warned to not go to the bridge, and that's why they're still alive today. But what I don't understand what the motivation is. The Mothman's trying to kill their relatives and friends, but not them. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
So, Justin, you read The Mothman Prophecies. I found a really good book. It's titled The Silver Bridge Disaster of 1967. Mm-hmm. And it's written by two women from the area. And I found it very informative. And one thing I noticed as I read through it, when they talk about different people that had given statements about the bridge disaster, who were there, part of the rescue effort, etc., no one mentions Mothman.
At all. That doesn't happen until much later. And it's not from any of the actual victims or survivors that were on the bridge for the most part. At the time of the incident, Mothman's not on the radar. I read the wonderful book called Mothman Prophecies. Again, thank you, Vincent, for sending this. On page 8, here's something that John Keel asserts, that unidentified flying objects have been present since the dawn of man, and it's an undeniable fact. Undeniable, Aaron. Paranormal phenomena are so widely spread and diverse and so sporadic, yet so persistent, that separating and studying any single event is not only a waste of time, but will automatically lead to the development of belief. Let that one sink in. So the way the book goes is, the first chapter is called Beelzebub Visits Point Pleasant or something, and John Keel actually shows up in Point Pleasant, and he is unshaven, and his car breaks down in the middle of the night, and he starts knocking on doors trying to get help. But it's the middle of the night and he looks like Satan, apparently. So there's this rumor going around that Beelzebub is in town when really it's just him. And he's debunking this. It's kind of like when you see the movie, the Conjuring or whatever, with the Warrens, and how they find one, you know, shaky pipe. So they're like, oh, well, this wasn't a ghost. This was a shaky pipe. So we can debunk and we become reputable because we have credits, because we debunk things. So in the first chapter, he's saying that there is a rumor about Satan visiting, and it was actually him, and it was debunked because it's him. Then he goes on to talk about these men in black that show up in town and are freaking creepy as hell, and they decide to ask, do you know John Keel, and have you seen UFOs? So he's already making himself sound important because these crazy men in black are actually asking about him. So he's asserting his importance in the book. Gray Baker, one of the many characters, is said he sees a UFO over Silver Bridge just before it collapsed. Yet at the time of the collapse, none of that is documented. 1966, a housewife named Mrs. Kelly describes a glistening metal disc hovering directly over a playground. I mean, I won't go into all the UFO sightings because there's just too many. Here's another comment that I highlighted in this book. This is John Keel's feelings on UFO enthusiasts. Unfortunately, their staggering solutions were obfuscated by intelligent explanations and preposterous terminology and philosophy. Few modern UFO enthusiasts have any educational background and understand such literature. So he doesn't have a high opinion about UFOologists. He says that the UFO phenomena is a trivial fragment, and what's happening in Point Pleasant is a much larger phenomena. At 11:30... on November 17th, 1966, that would be my birthday, but I wasn't alive yet, Mrs. Roy Groves was awakened by her barking dog at 4:45 a.m. in the morning. It's unusual for her little pet to bark late at night, so she got up to investigate. Really? Dogs don't bark at things? Okay.
You have some dogs, don't you, Justin?
Yeah, yeah. And there's weird assertions that he makes like that all throughout this book, that the moon was out, very bright. She looked out her kitchen and saw an enormous object hovering at the tree line, level in the field, over the side of Route 7. It was circular in the size of a small house and lit up. It took off and made a zigzag motion as it disappeared. That afternoon, a 17-year-old boy was driving down Route 7, not far from her house, when a huge bird suddenly dove at his car and pursued him for about a mile. He does not name this boy. He just says this boy exists, and he was driving along, and it was close by. On the 18th, two firemen of Point Pleasant, Paul and Benjamin, were in the TNT area when they encountered a giant bird with big red eyes. They said it definitely was a bird, and it started flapping. It was huge, nothing like they'd ever seen. They were unlucky to see it, as they vowed they never wanted to see it again. It invoked unspeakable terror. Every single paragraph in this book is almost a different description or account of things. There's another one where these two men were driving in their car, and they hit an invisible wall in the middle of the street. They reckoned to something, and they don't know what it was. On the afternoon of December 4th, 1966, 3 p.m., a large winged creature cruised along the Ohio River, just behind the airport. Pilots that saw this creature estimated that it was about 300 feet in the air and traveled about 70 miles per hour. But remember, he can go up to 100 miles per hour, so 70 is like cruising speed. John Keel explains that he went out to an area of a sighting of the Mothman, and as he was driving down the road, he was engulfed in fear. Shortness of breath, he was just freaking out, and all of a sudden the feeling went away. So he turned around and went back, and this one stretch of road is where it hit, and he gets out of his car. He's able to distinguish that it's like a zone. It's like a fear zone. And so it's about 100 feet in length and in kind of a circular area of the road. And if he steps out of it, he feels fine. But when he steps into it, he starts to freak out. But then when he goes back to it later, it's gone. So there's fear zones. He tries to talk to the police. He tries to talk to the FBI and the Air Force. And he is stonewalled around every corner. And nobody will talk to him. And then these men in black start snapping pictures of people. They're around Point Pleasant, and they're taking photos, and even back in New York. He says that this man, a tall, thin man, comes around a corner. His face was gaunt and pointed, and he was carrying a camera. He raised the camera and deliberately took our picture. Then he turned and ran. My friend knew nothing about the men in black, and it is not unusual to see tourists snapping pictures, but I did not make any comment about it because I knew what had just happened. These men in black, they have a very strong flash on their cameras. So they're going around and they're taking pictures of people that are involved. Every time they take a photo of one of these people, it happens so much in the book that I'm not going to go through each one, but every single account is written exactly the same. They say that the flash goes off and they're blinded and they're rubbing their eyes. And as they're rubbing their eyes, the men in black jump in their cars and take off or run away. And by the time they've oriented themselves, they're gone. A lot of eye rubbing going on. John Keel says that his phone would ring all the time and that it would get weird noises, beeping codes, whistles. And then he says that he actually has a phone guy come out to check his line because he thinks it's been tapped. He knows the phone company hasn't tapped his line because the FBI and the police don't like working with the phone companies. Just another assertion he makes. He says that they track the line all the way down into the building, going through all the floors into the basement of the building, and it gets to a main switch, and then it goes out to the thing. He says, I had studied books on the telephone system, and I knew exactly how all this machinery worked. This is John's assertion. Somebody misdialed his number, but his phone rang, and he realized that he had two phone numbers and he was getting extra bills in the mail and stuff. And he got very upset with the phone company about this. So he had his number turned off and he told everybody to call the other number. And then he ended up calling the other number. He says a woman picked up and he said, "Hi, this is John Keel. Any messages for me?" Now, this was a joke when I was elementary school kid, is you would prank call somebody and keep asking, "Is Justin there? Is Justin there?" And once you got the person irate, then Justin would call and say, "Hey, this is Justin. Any messages?" John Keel literally just wrote this into his book. This is a phone prank, but he's saying that he actually did it. Just pointing that out. He says the FBI and CIA hate each other and they both hate the phone company. So he had his line turned off and he said the line should have been totally dead, but there was power coming through it from somewhere. Technically, this should not be possible unless the telephone company in New York was the one tapping my phone. Now, he made the assertion earlier that he had read books and studied on telephones and how they work and that this should not be possible. I worked for a telephone company. Guess what? Copper pair lines run out to any house. You can call 911 on them. You don't have to have phone service on them. Also, he had two lines. He said he only had one. So did he have separate lines run to the house? What he's saying doesn't make any sense. And he's wrong. He expected there to be a blackout. And when it didn't happen, he was sort of disappointed. And then he realized that it was all because of the bridge collapse. But let me tell you this. If you read this book, you have to get to page 59 before you get any mention of the Mothman. It takes almost 60 pages of UFO and Men in Black garbage before you even get to a Mothman. I wondered why is that? And then I realized that John Keel was actually assigned to write a UFO book before he went to Point Pleasant. He was going to write a UFO book. And then he got wrapped up in the Mothman stuff and he just blended it together. Why is it called the Mothman? The local newspaper guy that was writing the story, he was a huge Batman fan, but he didn't want to call it Birdman because that sounds stupid. So he called it Mothman because that's cooler. A lot of magic behind the name there. John Keel doesn't think the Mothman is actually a physical being of this dimension or world. He thinks it's an alien, an interdimensional being. He thinks that Point Pleasant is a gateway. He's said so many different things that it's really hard to pin them all down. But this isn't a crypto kind of situation. This is a interdimensional crack in the fabric of reality, and Mothman just happens to be part of it, but the aliens were the bigger part. They say after the bridge collapse, Mothman disappears. Then you hear that after the bridge collapse, all these UFO sightings happen, nobody was paying attention, and then there's all these Mothman sightings. And the one photograph that you have of Mothman on the bridge, that's a current photo of the current bridge. That wasn't the original Silver Bridge. So he disappeared after the bridge collapse or not. And also that photo is total BS. it's just whatever's on the top of the bridge. So
if you look at pictures of the bridge, what everyone's circling there, just look at the other parts of the bridge. There's more than one of those things.
Yeah.
Either there are a ton of Mothmen all over that bridge and oh, wow.
Specifically on every corner of the tops of the bridge.
Look at what they're circling, and then look how there are others just like that all over the bridge.
It's the dumbest photo ever. Do you think Mothman? Okay, let's go through some ideas here. If Mothman is a bird or a physical thing of some type, a sandhill crane has a typical wingspan of 5 feet. Okay, so if this thing spreads its wings out, it's 5 feet. That's pretty good wingspan. California condor has a wingspan of 10 feet. So there's actually a bird in existence that has a 10-foot wingspan. Now, the California condor was an endangered species, and there was like I don't remember. It was like 25 of them in existence. And they went and tranquilized all of them, brought them all in, and got them to breed in captivity to get their numbers back up. California condor is 25 pounds. This is on the high end, you know, 10-foot wingspan, 25 pounds, and can fly up to around 50 to 60 miles per hour. Now, if you think about the description of Mothman, 7 foot tall, sometimes 10 foot tall, 200 pounds. An average NBA player who is 7 foot tall weighs well over 200 pounds and typically weighs up to 300 pounds. A linebacker, because they all say the Mothman was big and bulky, and plus you got to account for the weight of the wings. So a typical linebacker that's 7 foot tall weighs over 300, sometimes 400 pounds. How big of a wingspan does a hang glider have? Depending on the size of the person, an average man requires a 25-foot span for a hang glider. That's no flapping or thrust. Mothman can't physically exist. He doesn't have big enough wings for his size. It just, that's...
It's physics.
Physics. It's just physics. It will not work. But according to some people, he didn't flap his wings. He just raised them up and then he started going. Here's where I'm going to ask, why does he have wings then? What's the point of them? If he has the power of levitation, the power of flight, why does he have wings? I mean, I get it. Some birds can't fly and they have wings like an ostrich or a penguin. But why would he have them? It doesn't make any sense. We're back to, this is a magical creature and not a physical thing. And magical creature, whatever. The people that believe in this can't even agree on whether or not he caused the bridge to fall down or if he was a warning for it. Well, we already know what caused the bridge to fall down. And what kind of warning is that? Showing up? What about the alien guy in the truck that shows up and says, we'll see you again later? Like, there was no warning here. It's just this weird creature. People say there was so many eyewitness accounts of this creature that it's got to be true. Yet we have so many eyewitness accounts of Bigfoot, of Loch Ness, of all these other creatures. Mothman's actually on the low end of the spectrum if you're only accounting for the Point Pleasant, local area witness accounts. If you go out and YouTube Alabama leprechaun, there's hundreds of people who see a leprechaun in a tree in Alabama, but no one takes that seriously. We're not hearing about that. I guess I don't know if these people actually saw what they saw. I think most of them are making it up. I think most of them saw the news report, and it's a small town, you know, nothing against small towns, but hey, I'll get my name in the paper. Reports skyrocket after the first article. There's multiple articles there. You can find them. But if these people actually did see something, why are they all seeing the same thing? I have a couple theories, Aaron. One of them is a shared psychosis or groupthink, sort of a mob mentality, but it's a weird conformity thing or anti-conformity thing, depending on how you want to swing it. But people want to join in with greatness. They want to be part of something. They want to conform. Or they're tired of conforming. They want to step out of that and shine, get their 15 seconds of fame. And hey, I saw a UFO. I saw the Mothman. That's going to get them. And if you watch any documentary on YouTube, these people are still getting interviewed to this day about Mothman. It's hard to find interviews with the people that were actually on the bridge and survived, because nobody cares about the real incident that happened. Nobody cares about a mother and daughter and husband that plunged into the river. And what happened? The husband actually escaped the car and left his family?
Yeah, his window, so he went out the window and his family was left behind.
That's crazy and horrifying. If you don't think group psychosis is a thing, if you don't believe in it, I mean, have you ever seen the lines outside an Apple store and how long people wait for the new iPhone? You don't think that's not a group psychosis of, I got to have the next best thing? every time you get a like, you know, you get 100 likes on Facebook, oh, you feel good because now you've been confirmed. Now you feel like you've been established somehow. We all do it. Knowing that so many people acknowledge something you said makes you feel important. Just, this is a human psyche thing. And we're all very flawed. And we can misremember how things happen. It doesn't mean we're stupid. It's part of our human nature. I wouldn't have really believed it, but this one scientist was doing these different conformity tests and whatnot, but he says, he makes a statement. He goes, hey, you know, the movie or the TV show, the really popular TV show, Sex and the City. And everyone's like, yes, I watched that religiously, watched all the movies. And he says, you know, the actual title of the show is Sex and the City. Yeah, go Google it. It's not Sex and the City. It's Sex and the City. And you all got it wrong. Just something we do, you know. Darth Vader doesn't say, Luke, I'm your father. He says, no, I'm your father. He says something else. It's just, we don't get any of these things right. If this was an owl, if this was a large animal, they could misremember the incident.
Or it's dark.
Yeah, it was funny. My friend Jeremiah and I were, there's owls in our neighborhood. And we saw this huge light gray or white owl. And it had a huge wingspan. It looked over 2 feet, maybe 3 feet tall. It was gigantic. And I have small dogs, so I was kind of worried and like, I don't know if we want to let them out at night because this owl looks large enough that it could take one of our dogs. We're at Renfest, and Jeremiah is an outdoorsy kind of guy, and there's a wildlife rescue tent there. And the guy has boa constrictors, eagles, hawks, and he has an owl. And we start telling him about this huge owl that we've seen in our neighborhood. And the nature preserve guy says, that's impossible. They don't get that big. I almost watched my friend Jeremiah come unglued and get physical with the guy because they just could not agree. But this guy is a wildlife preserve expert. And he says, no, the owl you're describing does not get that large. But Jeremiah and I will swear all day long that it was a huge freaking owl. He said, they don't get big enough to take your little dog. And I'm like, I think they do. But are we misremembering in a traumatic event? You know, if you can't even remember the title of Sex and the City, are you going to remember the minutia of a scary event when things are happening at a fast pace?
Well, and scale is so difficult to discern at times, especially at night.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think that you have people that are jumping on the bandwagon, that have stories they want to tell that they've made up. You have people who are seeing things. We've talked about it before. I've seen a strange object. It may have been a craft. It could have been anything. I don't know. So I think there are honest people. It's like anything. You have your honest people, your dishonest people. I can't give a number on it. There's no percentage I can tell you that I feel out of all these stories, which ones are more legit than others. But I guarantee you there are people that were out at night and they saw something that flew past them, that rose into the sky. But to me, there's just nothing compelling here saying that it was a UFO. Like, I know we say UFO, unidentified flying object, flying saucer, what have you. Whether it was a strange craft or a strange creature, I think really what people are seeing or experiencing are probably much more mundane.
If the town of Point Pleasant, again, maybe 4,000 people at the time or less, has all these men in black and all this UFO activity, I think it would be a little bit more reported on. I think there would be, I mean, when you find the Mothman articles, they're not on the front page of their little newspaper, their registry. They're on page 6 in between, you know, the NAACP meeting on Thursday and the volleyball team on Friday. That's where they're putting these stories. And there's just a handful of them. they're not even taking it seriously.
Now, I will say, I think what possibly is going on with so many people being interested in Mothman is that in this one small town, you have all these different things going on. It's like a cornucopia. You have the Mothman, you have the Men in Black, you have unidentified flying saucers or craft, and you have, well, other strange creatures. At times, some people describe it as a bird. Some people say it's humanoid. But with all these different sightings and all these different experiences, I think people just think, wow, that must have been a crazy time for that year or whatever it was. It was about a year.
Yeah, 66 to 67.
So to them, this sounds exciting. And John Keel visited the area and spoke with many people and interviewed them, hence the book. I would say in defense of people who are really into this, there's a lot here to chew on. I just have to admit that when I look it all over, I don't see anything that meshes well together. To me, if this goes into one puzzle, then you have taken out some scissors and gotten out your glue and some tape and you forced it all together, because I just don't see any of this really going together.
In the town of Point Pleasant, they have a monument for the victims of the bridge incident, and it's a small plaque. And then they have a almost 10-foot tall art sculpture installation for Mothman. Priorities.
So what does that tell you? Mothman is good for tourism?
Yeah, but are they really trying to be a tourist destination?
I don't know, but look, if you make a monument to Mothman that is more impressive than the monument that is dedicated to the victims of the Silver Bridge collapse, then I don't know. I think that says volumes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's telling you what's more important. It's telling you what you should remember about our town. Oh, by the way, the Mothman, the big metal metallic thing, the art installation, as cool as it looks, it actually is not accurate. He has a head and like antenna and stuff. It looks more alien-like or insect-like than the actual descriptions, because the actual descriptions are more of a large owl or bird and not an insect.
Something without a neck.
Yeah.
Or possibly without a head. It's almost like the eyes are set in where the chest would be.
Yeah. But the artist took his own liberties and wanted to make it look more comic booky, just like the news editor decided to name him Mothman and not Birdman.
Yeah, when I posted the image to our Instagram and our Facebook, I just chose one that looked cool. Well, before we close out the show, Justin, I want to remind the listeners that we have a new premium episode out. Yep. The episode was chosen by Justin. It concerns Annie Dukin. And I think that for anyone that's really concerned about stories involving injustice, this is one you'll want to check out. And thank you so much for purchasing the premium episodes that we've released. So if you have been waiting for a new one, we have a new one out.
Yeah.
So you can get it on iTunes, you can get it on genypod.com, or you can go to cdbaby.com and get it there.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/genY today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/genY. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.